It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's a chance some Wisconsinites might be able to see the Northern Lights tonight. We'll learn about that and other stargazing opportunities this summer. First, a Bayfield County farmer survived for 19 days in the Canadian wilderness as a contestant on the 10th season of Alone, the History Channel's televised survival competition. Though she was the second of 10 contestants to call for help, she made Wisconsin proud by demonstrating her survival expertise, hunting, foraging, trapping, and braving the elements completely on her own.
It's a very hard decision, and it feels like it's too early. I don't want to go. I really like it here, but I think it's a huge accomplishment even just to be where I'm at, you know? I can't believe I'm here. It's a gift. It really is.
Ann Rosenquist is an organic farmer, forager, and survivalist in northern Wisconsin, where she co-owns Northwind Organic Farm in Bayfield County. She's here to talk about the challenges and triumphs she encountered while fending for herself in one of the harshest environments in North America. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. It's good to be here.
Where did you learn your very impressive, I gotta say, survival skills?
I think it's just my life, my whole life. I grew up on a small resort on the north shore of Lake Superior. I do a lot of primitive skills, different events, and teach at different things. Just picking up things and having the interest and reading books, and it's just kind of what I like to do.
What made you say, yes, I want to try this challenge of going on the show alone and see how long I could last?
Well, it's kind of the perfect opportunity because you get to go out and go as far as you can, and then there's a tap-out button, and they come and pick you up. So,
what were you hoping to get out of it? What made you want to be out there and show off these skills?
Well, the final prize, of course, is the final person out there. If they outlast everybody else, gets $500,000. That's nice, I guess. I'm not sure I ever expected to get that, but I learned a lot about myself out there and just what I'm capable of and what I'm not capable of.
Now, I want to set the scene here a little bit. I always assume that these shows, there is a camera crew that shows up from time to time around you. I have that wrong, right? There's just some stationary cameras.
No, actually, they give you a huge box full of camera gear, and they train you ahead of time. A couple GoPros and some other different cameras, and you film yourself. And you can have a couple going at one time. You know, you might have one on your body and one in the distance. You have a mic on you at all times. So you're basically filming yourself from the time you get up in the morning until you go to bed.
What was it like just being, totally alone, apart from the survival element of this, but the only person to talk to is, I guess, you?
Well, you can talk to the camera, but then you realize the camera ran out of batteries, so that's not, I don't know. There were different, there was a gray jay that kept coming through camp and my little camp, and there was squirrels that came through, and I didn't really feel too alone, actually.
What was the first challenge you decided to tackle there? Was it food, shelter, water? What was your priority as you settled into your temporary home there?
I basically was kind of working on food and shelter both at the same time. Food was hard. They didn't show everything I did for food, but I made a gill net. I had the wind coming at me the whole time, either from the south or the north. It was always coming in my direction on my little spit of land that I was allowed to stay in. So I decided that I was going to swim my little lure that I made out into the water, swim back, and then reel it in to get it out far enough. That was not successful.
What were some of your most successful foraging and hunting and fishing methods?
Oh, I found quite a bit of wild mushrooms. I did get a grouse. I tried, eating reindeer moss, which is edible if you, boil it, three times. If you don't boil it, then it's poisonous and you die. But I tried different things like that. Basically, I got so hungry and so so dehydrated that I had to come back.
Yeah, as I understand it, what made you have to come back? You're feeling pretty bad, and one of the reasons was a shortage of salt, which, you know, as Americans, that's not something we experience very often. What was it like to have this, what we take for granted, this mundane material salt, be such an obstacle in the wilderness?
Yeah, you know, I sort of had this inkling in the back of my head that maybe salt was important, and I actually, that could be one of your 10 items, but I kind of changed it up and didn't bring the salt, and I'm sorry I didn't do that, because that would have really helped me.
We're talking to Ann Rosenquist, organic farmer in Bayfield County, about her experience by herself on the TV show Alone on the History Channel, 19 days in the Canadian wilderness. You mentioned those 10 items, Ann, and I imagine you get to pick 10 things to bring with you. I imagine that must have been some excruciating decision-making. How did you set those priorities?
Oh, and I went back and forth. You know, I went back and forth of what I was going to bring, but I finally, you know, decided on different things. And I think if I were to do it again, it would be a different set of 10 things.
Now, if people out there are thinking, yeah, I'd like to try some survival type outdoor experience, but they don't have the kind of background you have, what kind of things could people do to learn those skills and learn what the challenges that they might face before they just put themselves out there?
Oh, I think you can find a lot of stuff on YouTube, and there's books written by different survivalists, like Morris Kochanski. He's an old timer. He's, you know, long gone, and other different people. Going to primitive skills events, they're kind of fun. They're usually a week long. They're all over the country. They're fun.
I was looking at the website for Northwind Organic Farm, and you clearly have a big priority on minimizing your environmental impact. Can you talk about kind of your philosophy and how maybe being out there and alone reinforced that connection with the environment?
Actually, you know, I think the two of them go side by side. It's kind of making do with what you have. We're off grid up here. We like to work with the environment instead of working against it. So we have a lot of different variety of crops. So if there's a crop failure, we're not going to go down. So we grow a lot of different fruits and vegetables, and it's all in different little areas. And it's kind of a crazy lifestyle. We have used cars and the off-grid thing with the solar panels, and we don't buy very many new things, you know.
Now, you went through this experience on 19 days in the Canadian wilderness. Given the opportunity, would you do it again?
Of course. I would.
Is there a type? Go ahead.
Oh, it was just fun. I mean, I'm more scared of people than, you know, of wild animals. So I wasn't scared out there. It was kind of like my own space. You know, I could just be my own person out there.
Yeah, you described it elsewhere as a spiritual experience when you look back at it. Could you talk about that a little?
It really was. It was so pristine up there. You know, we flew in a small plane even to get up to that lake, Reindeer Lake, way up in northeastern Saskatchewan. There's nothing down below. There's no people. There's no roads. It's so beautiful. And that white reindeer moss with the black spruce, it's more of a primitive environment, too. There's a lot less variety of plants.
Is there another place you'd like to do a challenge? Is there an environment in the world where you'd like to, you know, give it a try and spend 10, 20, 30 days there?
Probably the north. Probably somewhere in the north. I'm not sure I'm made for the tropics.
Do you have favorite areas in Wisconsin, whether you're just going for a hike or camping, even if it's not, you know, a more extreme survival type scenario?
Well, Bayfield County is pretty nice. I like to go up to Mount Ashwaubea and cross-country ski in the winter and kayak on Lake Superior in the summer and go for hikes and look for mushrooms, and a pretty peaceful place up here. And it's cool today. It's only 67 degrees.
Not bad. Now, you mentioned that on the farm you live off the grid as much as possible. The solar panels are one part of that. What are some of the things you've developed over the years to reduce your impact and reduce your reliance on outside inputs?
We have an electric tractor that we use for tilling. We have a few electric cars that we run around the farm with that we're using. We power them from the sun because we're totally off grid. We actually have batteries that charge up our systems. We also have a wind generator. So we're pretty self-reliant in that way.
Now, getting back to a loan, something I wanted to ask, Ann, you know, I got to say, it's kind of painful watching you in the last moments of your experience there, trying to figure out what was wrong, if you needed to call for help. Have you gone back and watched that yourself?
I have, and it's hard for me to watch. I didn't edit it. Uh-huh. I wish they wouldn't have put that in there, but I think they like to relate to the audience and stuff. I'd rather they would have showed me doing something instead of being all touchy-feely. I am sort of Scandinavian, you know.
Yeah. What didn't we end up seeing on the show that you wish had been there, seeing Ann Rosenquist in action?
Well, you know, there was that swimming with the lures. I also spent a lot of time chasing a squirrel that lived up above me. He had this huge complex with probably 20 different holes that it went into this huge pile of, like, cones from black spruce tree, and it was enormous. And he was out there just the king of whatever, and I got right up to him and I just missed him with my bow. But every time he saw me, he would hide the whole time. So I spent a lot of time waiting for him. It was kind of hilarious, actually.
And we'll leave it
there.
Thank you so much for sharing this experience with us.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
That's Ann Rosenquist, a forager and off-grid organic farmer living in Bayfield County. She survived for 19 days in the Canadian wilderness as a contestant on the 10th season of Alone, the History Channel's televised survival competition. New episodes of Alone air Thursdays at 8 Central on the History Channel. Coming up, did you know honeybees are farm animals that aren't native to the United States? A conservation biologist explains the difference between honeybees and native bees, North American native bees, and the role each plays in our food system. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you may have heard in the last few years that honeybees were under threat after an increase a few years back in a problem known as colony collapse disorder. Those honeybees are a non-native species in North America. They play a huge role in agriculture, both in honey production and for pollinating a wide variety of crops. But the concerns about honeybees and their importance in agriculture may have overshadowed a big ecological problem. Many of the nearly 4,000 bee species that are native to North America are under different forms of threats because of habitat loss, pesticides, and other reasons. Rich Hatfield is a senior endangered species conservation biologist and bumblebee conservation lead at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I want to spend most of our time on the native bees. I want to touch on honeybees for a moment. We might look at bees and think bees are bees. Honeybees have a very different background and story in North America. Can you tell us a bit about that history?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, they're not native. They were so they weren't naturally here. But back in the early 1600s, as Europeans were moving to North America, because honeybees provided a source of sugar and also a source of wax, they decided to bring them over. And the earliest records were in the early 1600s, I think 1620s. I think their first arrival was in Jamestown, Virginia. And records indicate that by sort of the mid 1800s that honeybees had reached to the West Coast and been spread by people all the way out there. But all of the history of the European honeybee or the Western honeybee coming to North America involves humans bringing them here. They weren't here on their own. Although it is worth noting that there is a early fossil of a related species, a related honeybee in the genus Apis that was found in Nevada a few years ago. So there may have been a native honeybee at one time, but that was millions of years ago and went extinct before people were ever in the picture.
And then let's turn to native bees. Thousands of different species native to the continent. I understand we've been talking about honeybees. The native bees in North America, none of them produce honey. Do I have that right?
None of them produced any measurable amount of honey. We have around 50 species of bumblebees, and they may produce sort of small pockets of honey that they feed their larvae when they're developing. But almost all of our native bees spend their winter hibernating. So they sleep through the winter. So they have a different strategy for surviving, whereas honeybees spend all summer making that honey so they have something to eat in the wintertime, and they overwinter sort of alive, which is different than our native bees.
What are some of the main strategies of overwintering, a big issue for a native bee here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are overwintering in a small hole in the ground, probably, you know, in your garden or in a yard somewhere. Some of them also overwinter in like pithy stems or twigs of trees or shrubs or even perennial plants. And so actually leaving some of that material in your yard is really important. Leaving some of those dead stems up and actually leaving some of the leaves on the ground provides really important insulation that protects those animals through the winter.
A lot of your work, of course, has to do with endangered and threatened bee species in North America. How endangered are some of these bee species?
The short answer to the question is we don't really know. There are, I think you mentioned, there are thousands of species of native bees to North America. And so in the United States and Canada, we have somewhere around 3,600 species. And for most of those species, we have very little understanding of their conservation status. But we do have a pretty good understanding of the conservation status of bumblebees, which are fairly well studied. Most people are probably familiar with them. They're large, robust, black and yellow for the most part, and they're fairly well studied. And we have some indication that around, or not some indication, the data indicates that around a quarter of them are facing some degree of extinction risk. And several of them are critically endangered. One species, Bombus franklinii, or Franklin's bumblebee, which is native to Northern California and Southern Oregon, actually hasn't been detected since 2006. And some folks actually think it may already be extinct. And then there in Wisconsin, you know, you have the rusty patch bumblebee, which is a federally listed endangered species. And so the two species I just mentioned, the rusty patch bumblebee and Franklin's bumblebee, are two bumblebees that are federally listed as endangered. And then there are actually seven yellow-faced or hyalaeus bees that are endemic to Hawaii that are also on the endangered species list. So I know that's kind of a long answer to your question, but in short, it sounds like really when we start looking at the data that around a quarter of the species are probably facing some degree of extinction risk.
What are a couple of the biggest reasons that these bees are endangered?
Well, you mentioned them in sort of your introduction of the segment. You know, habitat loss is a major one. The use of insecticides is also incredibly important, especially over the last, you know, 20 to 25 years or so, has been an increasing use of systemic insecticides, which are water soluble and get into plants and are expressed in the pollen and nectar, which are the only food for bees. So that's a really important source of a threat for them. And climate change is also a major factor as well. It's changing the time at which our plants bloom, and it's causing sort of crazy springtime, winter storms, and other things that are just impacting their life cycle. And so all of these factors sort of keep piling on top of each other, and you get a scenario that is commonly referred to sort of as a death by a thousand cuts. And another factor that's really happening, especially to some of our bumblebees, is disease is a major factor. So, you know, you mentioned honeybees at the beginning. There's some pretty good evidence that shows that when we move honeybees around, we're actually moving diseases around with them as well, and they can pass those diseases to our native bees as they visit flowers with each other. And there's also a commercial bumblebee industry that is believed to be amplifying and spreading diseases throughout the country. So a lot of threats out there. But the good news is a lot of those things are things we can do something about. We just need to band together and work to mediate to get rid of those threats.
And very briefly, just in our last half minute, you mentioned we can leave our yards untidy in the winter to help. Can we make a difference literally by planting native flowers for the rest of the season?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the great things about pollinator conservation is it's a build it and they will come scenario. If you start putting habitat in the ground, and the Xerces Society has a ton of resources on our website to help you do that, you will bring bees there. And that's what we're really encouraging folks to do, is to focus on building habitat rather than, say, getting a honeybee hive, because you may be bringing them into the system that doesn't have enough food to feed them already. So we want to focus on building habitat, and that will support our native bees and the honeybees that are already on the landscape.
Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Rich Hatfield with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. He talked to us today about native bees, many of which are endangered or threatened, and how to help them out around North America. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about what we can expect to see in the night sky in Wisconsin this summer. We had a shot at the Northern Lights tonight. Looks like that's not going to happen, but we may get more chances in the future. By the way, you could join in if you've seen the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. Love to hear your story. Maybe see some pictures over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, are we quitting our jobs less often? We'll look at the latest on the Great Resignation and other big stories from the world of work. Now, there were predictions earlier this week that people in many parts of Wisconsin would get a chance to see the Aurora Borealis tonight. Normally something only those in the far north of our planet can see. There's a South Pole equivalent, too, called the Aurora Australis. But looking at updated predictions, it looks like the Northern Lights probably won't quite reach here. Good news, though, we may have opportunities again in the near future. The aurora technically is happening almost all the time, day and night. It's what happens when solar wind comes up against the Earth's atmosphere. Also up in the skies, starting later this month, stargazers can see the annual Perseid meteor shower. We're talking about the Northern Lights and summer stargazing in Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite place to go and look up at the night sky here in Wisconsin? What are your favorite things to see in the sky? Do you have favorite constellations? Do you watch for meteor showers? Have you ever seen the Northern Lights? Love to hear you tell us about it. I have it. I've seen really faded dim. So I'd love to hear your story if you've seen a more vivid Northern Lights somewhere in the world. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Francisco Lay is a graduate student in astronomy at UW-Madison. He studies plasma astrophysics. Francisco, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've had these changing forecasts of Northern Lights. As I understand it, Francisco, we're probably not going to get them. How hard is it to predict if the Northern Lights are going to reach down this far?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's very hard to predict way beforehand. It's only like 24 to 48 hours when we can have like a very good prediction of the locations and whether that the coronal mass ejections that are the processes that produces these auroras can really produce them, or maybe they are too weak, or the conditions are not relevant to either produce an aurora at all. So, it's only about 24 to 48 hours mainly.
Now, I give a very short version of what's happening with the aurora. Can you talk us through, the sun is shooting out material. What is actually happening to produce these wild light shows?
Yeah, it's a very interesting process that, as you said, starts in the sun. So basically the sun has all this plasma. It's made out of plasma. It's a very hot gas that is ionized. And on top of that, it has a magnetic field. So it's like a big magnet Also, the Earth has its own magnetic field. And at some point, there are processes inside the sun that produces some ejections of plasma and magnetic fields. And we call it coronal mass ejections. And those ejections are very intense ejections of plasma and magnetic field. And at sometimes, but not every time, actually, a very few times, those ejections can be pointed towards us, towards the Earth. So then those ejections that we call coronal mass ejections travel through the interplanetary space until we reach it reaches the Earth. And when it reaches the Earth, it collides with our own shield, that is our own magnetic field. And then that magnetic field of the Earth deflects all this plasma towards the poles. So that's why these auroras are seen closer to the poles. And basically, those particles in the plasma and those magnetic fields that are moving towards the pole then fall into the atmosphere and ionize some atoms in the atmosphere. And those atoms are the ones that produces the light that we see, that we call aurora borealis or aurora australis.
Now, what determines the color of the lights? So you mentioned those atoms are getting hit by this plasma. Does it matter, I guess, what kind of matter, what kind of atoms are being hit to determine what the light show is going to look like?
Yes, indeed. So basically, each atom is ionized by these particles from the sun, and it depends on the atom which color we see. So I think, for instance, oxygen can produce this greenish colors, but we have several other colors depending on which atoms or molecules this particle hit.
Talking to Francisco Lay from UW-Madison, looking at the night sky, the aurora borealis, the northern lights, what causes it, what it looks like. You could join in with your reports at 800-642-1234. Also interested in your night sky observations of constellations, meteor showers, you name it. Join in at 800-642-1234. Looks like we've got some northern lights sightings to report here. John is with us in Partyville. John, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I've got a real good true story for you. I had a good experience when I was up in Alaska working on the pipeline up the north by the North Pole. Anyway, it was at Chandler. You can write this down to look it up if you want to prove I'm telling the truth. But
oh,
Chandler,
I believe you, John.
Camp. At Chandler Camp. Anyway, so I'd go out, you know, at night and observe the stars and the northern lights. And we're at the beginning of the Brooks Range. The northern lights dancing around the tops of the mountain up there. And this one mountain was balded, like, not peat, see? And so when it was daylight, I moaned.
John, we're losing your signal, but I think we got it. Seeing the northern lights up in Alaska. Now, Francisco, I don't know how much of a part of your research is going and watching the northern lights with your naked eye. Is that something you go to Alaska or elsewhere to try to see?
Oh, I would love to, but I haven't had the chance. Yeah, my work is more related to more distant objects called galaxy clusters that are very, very far away. But I've been very interested in trying to catch some auroras here in Wisconsin. Yeah, but I haven't had the chance yet.
Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, and Francisco, our sun is sending out this plasma that we end up seeing in the form of the northern lights here on the planet. We also there are a lot of different forms of cosmic radiation that we look at when we look at things like distant galaxies and supernovas and more, right? What is out there in space coming from, I guess, beyond our galaxy?
Well, that's a great question. Besides the sun that is sending us sometimes these coronal mass ejections, we are always receiving light, basically, light from very different objects like galaxies, very distant galaxies, or stars within our galaxy. And also sometimes we receive cosmic rays that are also particles, very energetic particles that are moving around the galaxy in our magnetic fields. And very recently, we've had some really nice observations of other particles called neutrinos that are really, really difficult to detect, but they're also part of what we can observe and receive here on Earth from the universe.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about my experience. It was late at night after my second shift job in Oak Creek, and I'm driving home. And I noticed there's a strange cloud, not many other clouds in the sky, just this one odd one. And I made it back to where I live in Greendale, and I pulled over into the parking lot of the high school. And I mean, it's well lit and everything. And I laid down on the back hood of my car, and I just watched this, and it was this huge circular dancing kind of whitish and greenish display. And nobody but me saw it. I was so frustrated. I wanted to share it with everybody, you know.
Mary, have you tried to replicate that, tried to get out and see it again? It's hard to do in that part of the state.
Oh, all of my instances have been random, just happened to see it. I've had maybe four or five of them.
Wow.
Last one, I was up in a plane, and I looked out, and there's another weird cloud. And I thought, oh, it's dancing around, and it was below me. And it didn't look at all attractive and beautiful like the ones you see where you're looking up, so...
Mary, I'm so happy for you. You got to see those. Thanks. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Now, Francisco, what has to happen for, you know, usually you have to be pretty far north to see the Northern Lights. What actually has to happen when, in terms of intensity, I guess, for the lights to be able to be seen here in Wisconsin?
Right. It has to have a pretty fairly large intensity. And also the magnetic field of the coronal mass ejection, this ejection that comes from the sun, has to have the exact alignment with our own Earth, the Earth magnetic field. Otherwise, we could not see any auroras at all. So I think this one was fairly weak. So then the intensity of the aurora would be only concentrated around the pole, the North Pole, so it won't go down to this latitude. So, yeah, it has to have a very large intensity to cover more area.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for sharing those stories, those sightings. We are talking about the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis. Now, you may have seen, like we did, there were predictions earlier this week that we'd have a great shot at seeing you in Wisconsin tonight. Revised forecast, the more accurate one, as we just heard, says probably not. But they will come back, hopefully soon. Francisco Lay is with us, graduate student in astronomy at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's the best stargazing you've experienced in Wisconsin? Have you seen the Northern Lights yourself in Wisconsin or elsewhere? Have you checked out some dark sky parks in the state? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about Wisconsin's night sky and how to catch a glimpse of the Northern Lights. Maybe not tonight. Some of the forecasts have changed. Francisco Lay is with us, graduate student in astronomy at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite place to do some stargazing in Wisconsin? Your backyard, planetarium, state park, you name it. Have you seen the Northern Lights? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Jane is with us in Chippewa Falls. Jane, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Jane?
Well, I was on Highway 29. It was back in the late 70s. And I've seen green and white Northern Lights on a horizon before. But this particular time, it was overhead ahead, and it was like a kaleidoscope of colors. We actually were driving, and we pulled over to watch them. I've never seen anything like it since.
Jade, thanks a lot. That sounds like a fantastic experience. I appreciate you sharing that. Now, Francisco, as I understand, you mentioned, you know, our magnetic field draws the this plasma from the sun. It's also kind of protecting us, our magnetic field, right, from different types of cosmic radiation. We're pretty glad it's there.
Yes, indeed. It's our kind of a shield, a very efficient shield that the Earth has to prevent any harmful radiation or some energetic particles to reach the surface of the Earth. So it's almost, we can say it's thanks to the magnetic field that some life here on the surface of the Earth has been able to survive and appear.
Thanks for that call. So pretty northern lights and key to our survival. I love it. Todd is with us now in Fort Atkinson. Todd, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, Todd?
Okay, so I'm 55 right now. And when I was in high school, around 17 years old, so this had to be the year of 84 and 85, I went up to the Boundary Waters, canoeing on a canoe trip, and we were lucky enough one night to go on the other side of the island and see it, and it was awesome. It was reflecting off the lake. Ooh. There was absolutely no lights, no light pollution.
That's fantastic.
So I'm wondering,
did you get to do it again, Todd?
No, I only saw it once.
All right.
I went up there 2 years, but I only saw it once. Now, if I was in the same spot now, and I saw it, would it be crystal clear like it was, or would it be hazy because of pollution?
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. Francisco, can you talk about some of the factors that let us see things, whether it's the northern lights or a good field of stars in the night sky, whether that's light pollution on Earth, or as Todd mentioned, you know, a haze, airborne pollution?
Right. I think the most important factor would be light pollution. So I would recommend to go to a very dark place and maybe some public parks. That would be great. There are, I think, at least in Dane County, I know that there are some parks that can give you a permit to stay overnight for astronomical observing. So I think that's a great opportunity. But I would recommend a dark sky, a way of light pollution, and also with a low horizon.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience and that question, Todd. And yeah, you can look up dark sky parks around Wisconsin. There are some official ones and some that are working in that direction. We are talking to UW-Madison astronomy grad student Francisco Lay. Before we go back to callers, I'm jealous of everybody, a lot of great sightings of the Northern Lights. I wanted to talk about these Perseid meteor showers. They're going to be kicking off soon, I understand, peaking in August. What are we looking for there, Francisco?
Yeah, so the Perseids are, as you said, one of the best meteor showers of the year. They are basically little debris of a comet that has, the comet has left all those debris in its orbit, and our Earth is moving towards that debris, and that's what we see. And then when we cross that path of debris, we can see these Perseid meteor showers. And as you said, the peak is in August 12th to 13th. It lasts from July 14 to around August 24, but I think the peak is around mid-August.
And when you say debris, as I understand it, like something the size of a grain of sand might show up as a flash. Yes. In the sky, right? It's just the speeds are so high?
Right. So they are very tiny, as you said, like the size of a sand grain. But as we move towards that cloud of debris so fast, they light up and kind of light up very, very brightly, and we can see it in the sky as a meteor, as a shooting star.
Francisco, hang on for a moment or two. I want to get a couple more stories of Northern Lights sightings. Linda is with us in Platteville. Linda, hi.
Hello. In April, I took some pictures just outside on my porch looking north. And the way to take the picture, the best way to see them is actually through your phone, because I think it picks up colors that you can't see with your naked eye. So if you, I'm only familiar with an iPhone, but if you put it on night mode, you will get the pictures. The videos, unless it's a really strong show, are not going to be picked up, but still pictures will pick up the colors.
Fantastic, Linda. Thanks for that. And share that on the Ideas Network Facebook page if you're able. Kathy is with us now in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I saw them down here on the west side. I live on Sawmill Road, just west of Gammon. And I always walked my dog down to Wexford Park. And this has to be 15 years ago, and usually about 10 o'clock at night. And I'm walking, and I get to the park, and I look to the north, and there's just white and green dancing all over above the trees. And I was so excited. I had never seen them before, and my husband's Swedish, so he grew up seeing them all the time as a child. And I ran back. I have to tell someone, but everybody's in bed and everybody's got kids. So I knocked on my neighbor's door and I told him, if you want to see the Northern Lights, they're just spectacular. And he wasn't even interested.
Oh, no. Well, you're a good neighbor, Kathy. Thank you so much. Thanks for everybody sharing your Northern Lights stories. Francisco, what other kind of things do you like to watch for? I know you're watching other galaxies in your work. What other kind of things do you like to watch for in our night sky here in Wisconsin?
Oh, I really like the to kind of form the constellations with the stars that I can see, because I am originally from Chile, so I'm from South America, the southern hemisphere, so we have another whole different sky with different constellations and objects. So I'm always finding something new in this northern sky.
Fantastic. What has been your favorite constellation to discover up here in our northern hemisphere selection?
I got fascinated when I saw the Big Dipper for the first time, because I knew the name, but I couldn't imagine the Big Dipper in the sky. But then it made complete sense. So yeah, it was great.
Let's flip that around, because the Big Dipper is one of the few constellations I am able to identify without any help. Is there something like that in Chile in the southern hemisphere where that's the one constellation everybody knows about?
Right. I think in analogy to the, for instance, the star Polaris here in the northern hemisphere, we have the Southern Cross. Mm. That is our kind of constellation to find the southern pole in the sky. So it always points towards the southern pole. So the Southern Cross is, I think, our main constellation in the southern hemisphere.
Francisco, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Francisco Lay is a graduate student in astronomy at UW-Madison. He studies plasma, astrophysics. He talked to us about the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, the Perseid meteor shower. Thanks to everybody who called in. Wow, so many of you on the line. Again, I'm kind of jealous of everybody. I've only seen, kind of the faint, you just thought, am I imagining that, or is it really the Northern Lights? I didn't know. You can keep sharing your sightings, though, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Pictures, please, if you got them.